KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, gaming the system. Are some California doctors getting larger Medicare reimbursements than they deserve? Also, life after a life sentence. The growing number of convicted murderers being released on parole.
I do plan to walk a straight, narrow path and give back to society. You know, it's remarkable that I was given a second chance when I didn't give my victims a second chance.
Plus, remembering a socialist colony that attracted hundreds to the Southern California desert a century ago, and the latest high-tech tool helping farmers save water, aerial drones.
We joke about being able to take pictures of individual bugs sitting on a plant. So, you know, with the right algorithm, you can count all the bugs on the plants if things worked out.
It's the California Report. We begin today with a special investigation from the California Report's health team. Officials with Medicare, the federal health program for elderly and disabled Americans, recently released reams of billing data. The goal, to enlist the public in spotting doctors who might be manipulating the system to collect more money. The California Report partnered with the independent newsroom ProPublica, conducting an exclusive review of the state's physicians. What we found are hundreds of California doctors charging far more than is typical for routine office visits. Our health reporter April Demboski has more.
Most doctors go into medicine to help people. They'd rather be in a clinic caring for patients than in a back office writing bills.
They hate it. They hate it.
Patrice Morin-Spatz is a medical billing expert. She says in order to get paid, doctors have to get familiar with an intimidating book listing thousands of billing codes.
It ends on page 940.
Let's take the example of office visits. Under Medicare, they get billed on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 is a simple, short visit and is the least expensive. 5 is the most complex and most expensive. Michael Leidy directs public policy at the California Nurses Association. He says some billing departments fudge it. A doctor does an exam worthy of a level 4 visit, but bills for a level 5. That's called upcoding.
There's no question that the medical group has every incentive to upcode. No question.
The typical elderly patient in California receives about 1 or 2 of these highly complex visits a year. But hundreds of doctors in the state are billing Medicare for much more than that. One of them is Gary Ordog, an emergency medicine doctor who sees patients in his office in suburban Los Angeles. On average, the data show that each of his patients received 30 of these highly complex visits.
That sounds funny to me.
Coding expert Morin Spatz says that kind of billing pattern is very unusual.
Huge red flags really high up in the sky, waving their arms ferociously.
She says most doctors are trying to do the right thing, and sometimes there's a reasonable explanation for repeat complex visits. But she couldn't think of any in this case.
I think that they are trying to code based on how much money they want, as opposed to coding with a goal to satisfy the requirements of each particular level of service.
Several years ago, California's medical board tried to revoke Ordog's medical license for incompetence, making false statements, and inadequate record keeping. He is currently practicing on probation and did not respond to multiple requests for comment. In fact, only one of the doctors we contacted got back to us. Jeffrey Mace is a cardiologist in Santa Cruz County. He ranks number 3 in the country for the number of highly complex visits he billed. For that, Medicare paid him $380,000 in 2012. In an email, Mace said his patients are sicker than most, and he's a more dedicated doctor than most. He never takes vacation or lunch breaks. He said, quote, by being available and devoting a great deal of resources to the patients, I hope that this comprehensive care translates to improved quality of life for my patients. Medical billing consultant Lamar Blunt says some upcoding is an honest mistake, and some isn't.
Sometimes it's greed. Sometimes it's habit.
Sometimes it's technical. He says some mistakes are the result of poorly designed algorithms in a doctor's electronic medical record system. Whether mistakes or outright fraud, the costs of overbilling ultimately come back to the taxpayers. For the California Report, I'm April Dymbosky.
That story was co-reported by Lisa Alafaris and Lisa Pickoff-White. You can look up billing data for your Medicare doctor by going to californiareport.org. For decades, California inmates serving sentences like 25 years to life had very little chance of being released. Parole for these so-called lifers was routinely denied by the State Board of Parole hearings or blocked by the governor. But a dramatic change is underway. Since a key state Supreme Court ruling 6 years ago, the number of lifers winning parole has steadily climbed. Since then, more than 1,700 have been released. The change is being felt on both sides of the prison walls.
Now what we're going to do, we're going to ask every participant in alphabetical order and call your name and get your certificate, take a picture, and go back to your seat.
It's graduation day at San Quentin Prison.
Mr. Calix, Mr. Keppel, Mr. Cooper.
About 50 inmates, most of them lifers, are collecting their diplomas from a course in leadership. After the ceremony, Associate Warden Jeff Lawson says that as more and more lifers are granted parole and leave prison, the inmates are taking notice.
Most of these guys understand there is light at the end of the tunnel now, so it just helps improve the overall environment for them. And it gets the ones that were maybe straddling the fence to actually get off the fence and get on the right side.
Inmate Dwayne Reynolds just completed the leadership course. On the way back to his cell block, he describes to me the crime that sent him away more than 25 years ago.
As a matter of fact, what I did was I murdered my supervisor, high on drugs, so my life was out of control.
Reynolds was 30 at the time. His sentence, 26 years to life. He's now 54. Despite being denied parole 3 times, Reynolds is hopeful. Next month, he says, the parole board will decide, once again, if he's suitable for parole and no longer a risk to society. I ask him if he thinks he's suitable.
That's a very difficult question for me. I will say this. I'm a changed individual, but the fact that I took another human being's life, that's a hard question for me.
Reynolds says he and his fellow San Quentin inmates are very aware that after years of routine denials of parole, word is out. If you do the work, complete the programs, and stay in line, release is a very real possibility.
The fact that people are going home is just really encouraging to a lot of individuals.
Since 2009, more than twice as many lifers have been paroled than in the previous 2 decades combined. There are several reasons for that. State Supreme Court rulings that made it tougher to deny parole to inmates that are no longer a threat to public safety. Also, Governor Jerry Brown's 12 appointees on the parole board are granting parole at a much higher rate than previous commissioners. And unlike his predecessors, who usually block parole for murderers, Governor Brown is allowing 80% of the parole recommendations to go forward. While you might think that freedom, after decades in prison, is all upside, the reality is more complicated. Gregory Rivers was just released from Solano State Prison after serving more than 3 decades for a murder. The former gang member was 17 at the time. Now 55, he recalls that first full day on the outside.
That morning when I woke up, got dressed, it's about 6 o'clock in the morning, I was scared to open the door. Because though I'm free physically, mentally, I still have some work to do.
He worries that somehow his newfound freedom will lead to trouble and right back to prison.
I do plan to walk a straight, narrow path and give back to society. You know, it's remarkable that I was given a second chance when I didn't give my victims a second chance.
Rivers is standing inside a Chinese restaurant in Berkeley. He is, in a sense, the guest of honor, joining a dozen other former lifers recently released from prison.
Congratulations. It's great to see you.
The gathering is part celebration, part reunion. All the men were trained to be drug and alcohol counselors while they were still in prison. Some will continue that work now. Sitting around a large corner table in the restaurant, the men share their feelings and their fears. One of them, Vandrick Towns, remembers entering prison at the age of 17, thinking, he says, he was the biggest, baddest person alive. As the others reach for more food and clean their plates, Towns says he's learned to be vulnerable, how to cry, and how to give his pain a voice.
That's something I never did during my childhood. I never talked about things, whether it's good or bad. I never talked. I stayed isolated. Today, I'm comfortable with talking because I'm comfortable in my own skin.
Out of prison less than a year now, Towns works at Options Recovery Services in Berkeley, a nonprofit group that works with inmates and parolees. But he remembers finding that first job wasn't easy.
But for my first 6 months, nobody wanted to touch me. When it got to the job interview, oh, you're very articulate, you're very educated. Oh, you're a parolee, sorry. You know, next.
Another former lifer, Greg Jones, was also released from Solano Prison just over a week ago. On this day, he's celebrating something most of us take for granted.
I got my ID today, and I was elated. Yeah, that was a big deal. And I got my driver's license today also.
The men laugh and warn him not to text and drive. But there are plenty of serious moments, too. They talk about getting reacquainted with their children and grandchildren. David Hillary stresses the importance of keeping a positive attitude.
Every day I have to go to bed and knowing that this is an opportunity that I was given and I will never squander it like I did before in the past.
The philosopher in the group seems to be James Thomas. Crisply dressed in blue jeans and a white button-down shirt, Thomas talks about humility and resisting disappointment when he's turned down for jobs. The key, he says, is patience.
And everything good will come to you if you just wait for it. I've tried to chase it, and I guarantee you it's an uphill battle trying to catch it. Because no matter how close you get, it's always going to be one step ahead of you.
There are still more than 26,000 California inmates serving life sentences with the possibility of parole. Many will never get out. Those who do will need the kind of support these men have found to make the most of their second chance. We have a video with another former lifer, along with photos and detailed parole data. You'll find it all at californiareport.org. Many farmers in the Central Valley are facing drastic reductions from their usual supplies of state and federal water. So growers are trying to save every drop of water. As the California Report's Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca explains, farmers are looking to the sky, not just for rain, but for the newest water-saving tool, aerial drones.
When we last checked in with him 5 years ago, Zach Sheely was already on the cutting edge of water conservation, using his iPhone to check how much water his tomatoes are getting while at his opera lesson. Zach and his dad, Ted, were among the first to convert to remote-controlled drip irrigation on their sprawling Kings County farm. Now they're taking one more step into the future.
So this screen in the box right here, this is going to give you the real-time video feed?
The FPV, the first-person view. Okay.
Listening to farmers programming a drone is sort of like eavesdropping on NASA's mission control.
We've got a tablet, which is going to help figure out the mission.
Yep.
So, and then
help plan the mission.
Okay, and that's connected also to the ground control station.
But
okay,
as cool. Ted Sheely explains, the mission here has to do with coyotes gnawing on his drip lines.
Our mission was, we don't have enough water, and having a coyote chew a line in two, that line of trees from that point on is getting half the water.
Two rows of drip irrigation lines run to each tree in his orchard. The Sheelys grow more than 1,000 acres of pistachios in this remote corner of Kings County.
Oh, yeah, coyotes is a problem. Humans are a problem where they'll come out and they'll hunt doves or something in our orchard, and the shotgun BBs will put little holes in all the lines.
Zach's hoping a thermal camera mounted in the drone will pick up leaks in the orchard so they can fix them faster. Some of the neighbors have gathered to watch a drone that can collect video and still images of farmland.
So we should be good to go. So I'll need everyone to clear out right here. All right, flip them both.
That was fast. Take a long minute.
The company doing the demo is called Honeycomb. 31-year-old co-founder John Foss grew up farming in Oregon.
We designed this for farming. That's why it's called Honeycomb, you know. It's like, this is your worker bee out over your field scanning your crops.
Altitude is 121. Ground speed is 28. Heading to waypoint 5.
But demo day turns out to be really windy, and the little plane careens wildly above the orchard before making an emergency landing.
Lands it. Nice. Touchdown.
Hopefully it's okay.
I'm sorry you got a little ding in your wing there. But
nothing a little Gorilla Glue won't fix, says Foz, who says his company can't keep up with orders for farm drones fast enough.
We want it to be the tractor of the sky. We want it to be reliable and rugged.
Zach Sheely says he's sold on the drone, which will set him back about $15,000. He says that's far less than what the lost water from leaks might cost him, potentially $1,000 an acre. The drone can cover his whole pistachio orchard in an hour. Zach says it would take a farm worker over a week to drive up and down the same rows of trees on an all-terrain vehicle looking for chewed irrigation lines.
So if I can eliminate that job or use that person more wisely than just having him drive mindlessly up and back looking for leaks, then it just benefits my business and probably is going to like his job a little better, too.
Farmers represent a growing share of the drone market. Unlike in cities, using drones on farms generally doesn't raise privacy concerns. A trade group that represents drone producers predicts farms will eventually account for 80% of the commercial drone market.
I think the technology is here to stay. For agricultural purposes, they're going to be a real powerful tool.
That's David Zoldowski, who heads the Center for Irrigation Technology at Fresno State. He thinks California farmers will be early adopters, using drones to fine-tune the watering of their crops.
We joke about being able to take pictures of individual bugs sitting on a plant. So, you know, with the right algorithm, you could count all the bugs on the plants if things worked out.
Right now, that's a big if. It's still unclear just how much leeway farmers will have to fly drones. At this point, the FAA doesn't allow their commercial use. Farm groups have been weighing in heavily to change that. Later this year, the agency may propose rules to cover the small drones farmers are starting to buy. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Kings County.
This month marks the 100th anniversary of the founding of a socialist colony called Llano del Río. It sprawled across Southern California's Antelope Valley, lasting about 3.5 years, and at its peak, over 1,000 people lived there. KCRW's Avishai Artsy caught up with a group of artists who paid tribute to this experiment in communal living.
I'm at the site of Llano del Río, standing in the stone ruins of what was once a house. Dance theater artist Christine Suarez slowly sways with a thin veil of white tulle, while her collaborator, Alex Schilling, reads from a letter written by a Llano settler.
We can't achieve the impossible. We are still under the thumb of capitalism. Our colony is a corporation. But instead of using it for parasitical advantage, the benefits go to us, the workers. Isn't that swell?
Suarez adapted some of the letters based on research and correspondence she discovered. She's one of a couple dozen Southern California artists who, on a recent weekend, staged performances about the legacy of Llano del Río.
So you're going to start facing this way, clockwise, okay, and hold your hand up.
Artist Leora Ween installed a maypole. She and a few other people grab colorful ribbons and dance in circles around the pole, weaving the fabric into a tight pattern.
They celebrated May Day, which has become a day for workers' rights, for advocating for things like the 8-hour work week. There is archival footage of the May Day Festival with the maypole. So that was the inspiration.
Job Harriman, a lawyer and socialist leader, founded Llano del Río in 1914. He had run for Los Angeles mayor twice, but lost because he defended the union activists who bombed the LA Times building in 1910. So he convinced a band of idealistic young progressives, farmers, and others to start a new life in the desert.
In 1910, 1911, 1912, an average wage, a good wage, for skilled labor, $2.50 a day, 10-hour day, 6-day week. Llano was promising $4 a day, 5-day week, and 8-hour day. So that was kind of revolutionary.
That's historian Paul Greenstein. He co-wrote Bread and Hyacinths, a book about Llano del Río. He says Llano settlers built a printing press, planted fruit orchards, alfalfa, and raised dairy cows and rabbits. But it wasn't all hard work.
They had a mandolin orchestra. They had the best baseball team in Antelope Valley. They had weekly dances, which were widely attended by everybody.
When I get tickled, my think tank fills with steam.
Greenstein brought a wax cylinder player to the Llano site, a model that would have been used 100 years ago. He also brought this along, a 1913 Metz Roadster. Naturally, I asked for a ride, even though it was missing a few parts. No water pump, brakes, headlights.
It also has no clutch.
Where's the seatbelts?
I didn't hear what you said.
Having a car like this would have come in handy at Llano del Río. The colony was spread out over several miles, with plans for further expansion. Founder Job Harriman tapped a radical feminist architect named Alice Constance Austin to design the city. Here's artist and organizer Cindy Rehm.
She had this whole crazy idea about underground systems where, you know, laundry would be put down the chute and it would be taken away and meals would be delivered underground. So that would be this kind of way that women would be liberated from working in the kitchen.
Austin's plans were never carried out. The community rejected what they saw as concrete, prison-like buildings. Instead, they lived in tents or adobe houses, most of which were destroyed by storms, leaving only the remains of a cistern, a hotel, a dairy farm, and a grain silo. That's where electronic artist Stephen Fish performed this concert of echoing, ambient music. Didia DeLizer is a professor of geography and a Llano expert. She says the commune folded for a few reasons. Internal strife, a lack of reliable water, the World War I draft. In 1918, some residents boarded a train to Louisiana and formed New Llano, which lived on for another 20 years.
We're looking at the ruins of the colony now, but it represents a time of real hope and the earnest and sincere efforts of 1,000 or maybe 1,500 people who lived here, who sought to build a bright and different future.
Which, when you think about it, is a lot like Los Angeles today, a place where people still move to start over, pursue their dreams, and create a bit of paradise in the desert. For the California Report, I'm Avishai Artsy in the Antelope Valley.
If you think about the kinds of bugs you'd find in a city, you might imagine ants, cockroaches, bees, maybe mosquitoes, or even bed bugs. But that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. In fact, there are probably millions of different insects out there. And now, a large urban insect study is underway in Los Angeles, where scientists are helping Angelenos search out the bugs in their backyards. Alex Schmidt took a look.
One thing about studying insects in urban backyards, it's noisy.
Well, you're definitely getting the urban soundscape. There is no doubt that you're not out in the country.
That's Natalie Breca. She's one of 30 volunteer property owners in the study. For the next few years, the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles will be collecting bugs in her yard. On this particular day, entomologist Lisa Gonzalez is there to reinforce Breca's insect-catching trap. It's about 5 feet tall and made of netting. Gonzalez explains how it works as she hammers in the stakes.
Insects are basically just randomly flying by. The insects get intercepted by this trap. If they're trying to escape, they're going to go towards the apex of the trap. And there's a little hole at the top of that bottle there, and so they fall in and they get collected in the ethanol.
The point of the study, in a nutshell, is to try and understand how an urban environment affects living creatures. Dean Pencheff is managing the study for the museum.
How is it that we, as we civilize this city and have paved it over and diked it and dammed it and channelized it, have affected the diversity of the life that lives here? And the tool that we're using to study that is insects. So, yeah, if you want to study biodiversity, you pick the most biodiverse group on the planet.
The stats on insects are pretty impressive. Scientists know about 1 million insect species now, but they estimate there are probably closer to 10 million out there. Every week, each site participating in the study is collecting hundreds of bugs. Most of the participants found out about the study through the Natural History Museum. They all have to change the jars out once a week and keep an eye on the trap. But to Natalie Breka, it's no problem.
It's just amazing for our city to see what's really here. So yeah, the three-year commitment wasn't that big of a deal to us.
This is actually one of my favorite groups of flies. They're called flower flies or surfeit flies.
Entomologist Lisa Gonzalez is doing a bit of show and tell. She's brought in a specimen to show Natalie Breka's daughter.
And in some cases...
It looks like a bee.
Yes, actually, I'm really glad you noticed that because I was going to bring that up, that a lot of them are what we call mimics of bees or wasps, meaning they look just like a bee or they look just like a wasp, but they're not. They're a fly.
For some participants, this experience is the coolest part of the study, having a personal insect consultant to explain what's really going on in their own backyards.
So far, we've only collected, I want to say, maybe about three or four of this particular species. But I wanted to bring this one to show you because it's just so beautiful, and this is one from your house.
Whoa, cool and beautiful.
The specimens collected in the Breka's yard are going back to the museum lab to get sorted and archived forever, and possibly yield exciting discoveries. This is one of the longest studies ever to look at insects in an urban environment. Here's study manager Dean Pencheff again.
No one has attempted to do this kind of large-scale, long-term trapping type of study.
Pencheff says there's a good reason insects tell us so much about adaptation and the natural world. Their short lifespans.
We think of organisms as living through many, many years, but most organisms, of course, a year is much longer than their lifespan. Because if you're dealing with something like a small fly that has a really rapid life cycle, you watch evolution play out.
The study continues through 2016, and scientists all over the world are waiting to get their hands on the data. Geneticists, specialists in bacteria, and many others could learn new things, like new species discoveries, a cure for disease. Anything's possible. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt in Los Angeles.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. Our engineering team includes Howard Gelman, Danny Bringer, and Jim Bennett. The online crew includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, Pat Yowen, Olivia Allen Price, and David Marks. This week, we have to say goodbye and good luck to our terrific interns, Kate Hunt and Matthew Levin. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, Craig Miller, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.